It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios Maria Tomczyk with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
No job this week.
He's no job off. This week. He's slacking.
I don't know where he is. I can't remember what he said.
I think he's traveling somewhere.
I think so, too. All right. A lot to cover, so let's dive in, starting with the new prediction that the state is going to be a no-strikes-allowed state.
Yeah. Boeing sat down with the state's congressional delegation, the U.S. congressional delegation, in March. Back in March, both of our U.S. senators and a bunch of our representatives, and basically told them that, look, we're thinking of leaving the state. We're thinking of packing up the 787 production line and taking it somewhere else unless we can get the union to agree to a no-strike deal, to a long-term no-strike deal. That is just, I think, another sign that Boeing is trying to shoot itself in the head. You know, I knew that they would try to blame the delays on the 787 on the strike, last year's strike, because the IAM, the Machinist Union, went out on strike for 2 months last fall in order to win some concessions on their contract. And, you know, it just is not true that the strike had anything to do with the delays on the Dreamliner. The current delays on the 787 came because of problems with the subcontractors in Japan. It has absolutely nothing to do with the quality of work of the folks who work for Boeing here in the state. Had absolutely nothing to do with the strike. And the fact that Boeing is using this now, during a time of economic upheaval, to try and say, look, we're gonna move jobs out of the state if you don't give us this concession. It's basically trying to rewrite the contract with the Machinist Union, you know, after it was already signed. That's just not fair. It's the one story this week that really got my ire up, you know, was reading about this. And it comes on the heel of Boeing announcing that they're buying up a plant from one of their subcontractors, Vought Aircraft Industries, which is based in Charleston, South Carolina. So it's as if they're saying, well, you know, here we go, we're going to start up another production line. Let's see what we can get out of the workers in the state of Washington before we move the production line over. Maybe we can get this no strike deal going, and who knows? Maybe they'll come to the table and say, let's get some other concessions from the union while we're at it. It just is like there's no end.
Because these one reason, because these unions cover oftentimes are across the country.
Yeah, yeah.
So mm-hmm. something that a union decides here could affect
others. Yes, across
in
the country,
states,
in other Boeing plants as well.
All right. Anything else about Boeing?
No, let's move on.
All right. Big bonus this week for the head of Seattle City Light, I believe.
Yeah, Mayor Nichols announced that the CEO of Seattle City Light was going to get a $40,000 bonus this year. But, you know, Jorge Carrasco, the CEO, hasn't met the conditions for the bonus under his contract. Now, the contract, of course, you know, Nichols has been and the city has been saying, oh, well, it's in the contract that he can get a bonus. And, yes, that's true. It is in the contract that he can get a bonus. It's also in the contract that the city doesn't have to pay him a bonus in any year of his employment. It's also in the contract that he should meet certain criteria before he is paid a bonus. And this year he hasn't met that criteria. The biggest piece of the problem being that he hasn't that City Light still hasn't paid off all of its debt. That's a big thing that should be done. That's a big job performance issue here. City Light needs to pay off its debt, and it's paid it down, but it hasn't paid it off. And just looking at it historically, Carrasco received a $5,000 bonus in 2005 and again in 2006, but, you know, he didn't receive any bonus at all the last 2 years, 2007 and 2008. So why now, in a year when the city is scrambling for money, city employees are at risk of losing their jobs, is Mayor Nichols shelling out $40,000 to keep this guy, you know, working here instead of letting him move on to another job? You know, if he's not happy working in Seattle and he wants to make more money, let him go. You know, take somebody else working in the hierarchy in City Light, promote him to the job and say, look, see if you can do a better job, you know? If you're willing to work for the wages we're willing to pay, great. If you're not, get out of here, you know?
In addition, I believe City Light is raising their rates for ratepayers.
Well, some rates are falling, some rates are going up. So, you know, when ratepayers have to pay more and other city employees are looking at maybe losing their jobs, why are you taking $40,000 and giving it to somebody who hasn't met the goals in their contract?
All right, moving on. King County looking at a budget shortfall.
Yeah, King County's short on money as well. The King County executive, Kurt Triplett, he had said that some city services would be, well, most city services would be funded through June 30th, and that some then would be terminated. Well, he gave those programs a two-week extension. Those that were going to be terminated weren't going to get their funding. He gave them a two-week extension while the city council considers and will vote early next week on which programs will get funded through the year end and which ones will get cut off. Triplett wants the council to eventually approve a 0.1% sales tax increase and to go to the voters probably late this year. But, you know, that's going to be a tough sell in a year when people are struggling economically to have them go to the polls and vote to tax themselves more, you know, especially with the sales tax. In many parts of King County, people are paying already paying like 9.5% sales tax. And to go any higher to fund county services is going to be a really hard sell. But there's some good news out of this, too. Last week we talked about the tenants union, right?
Correct.
And the tenants union was one of those groups that was going to be losing their funding. Well, an anonymous donor stepped forward and gave them $25,000, which is going to go a long way to helping the tenants union stay operating for at least a while. So that's some good news in all of this, that there are some generous people out there who can afford to help fund services that the county can't. So, but I think it's very interesting. We talked a little bit about this, I think, in April or May. I'd just come off of working tax season in my paying job, and seeing that there were so many people who were paying so little tax this year that it made me wonder, you know, the federal government thinks that it's going to get all this money in from tax revenue that's not going to come in. That's the same is going to be true on the state and local levels, and we're seeing it now.
All right, and then finally, locally, Maury Island looking at halting operations there, at least temporarily.
Oh, yeah, the new state public lands commissioner, Peter Goldmark, he sent a letter out this week to the company that's trying to dig a big gravel mine on Maury Island in an environmentally sensitive aquatic reserve on Maury Island, I should add. The company is Northwest Aggregates, and folks might remember last year the hotly contested race at the polls between Peter Goldmark and Doug Sutherland for the state public lands commissioner job. Doug Sutherland being a conservative, he was the incumbent, being a conservative who's never seen a logging plan that he didn't like. And Peter Goldmark running on the platform of someone who actually understands environmental law and thinks that it ought to be applied, at least in some cases. And this is a case where you can look at, gee, if you voted for Peter Goldmark, you can look at it and go, I think I voted for somebody who's actually going to keep a campaign promise here, because he sent a letter to Northwest Aggregates saying, look, I'm not satisfied with the information you provided to the former lands commissioner, Doug Sutherland. I don't think there's enough detail in there on what you're going to do to protect the eelgrass beds on Maury Island, which are important for salmon and for keeping the Puget Sound, keeping the whole Puget Sound clean. You know, he basically said I'm not satisfied with any kind of remediation that you've said you were going to do. I want you to answer this list of questions by a certain date, by July 30th. And maybe we'll let the lease go through, because in the waning days of Doug Sutherland's term as public lands commissioner, he had basically just signed off and allowed Northwest Aggregates to lease the land for the gravel mine for a minimum fee of $1,500 per year. And in doing that, he basically said, well, I'm satisfied with the environmental statement that you gave me. And Goldmark's basically saying, I'm not satisfied with that environmental statement. We're putting the whole project on hold until you satisfy us that you're not going to have a huge impact on the sound. So that's good news. And I thought I would just talk about that a little bit, because, boy, seldom do you feel that people you've elected are really doing their jobs. And in this case, I feel that way about Peter Goldmark.
$1,500 a year is all they're paying.
$1,500 a year is all they're paying. And they want to build this big huge dock as well on the water in order to transport
it's
the gravel.
I thought it was like 200 or 300 feet long.
Oh, I think it's about 300 feet long. Yeah. And it's going to obviously have an impact on the sound. I mean, there's no way around it. In addition to the gravel mine itself, they're going to have to transport the gravel. And to do that, they have to build this big dock, and it's going to be a mess.
Wow.
So.
All right, moving on to national and updates related to the healthcare bill.
Yeah, the healthcare bill had a couple of things going on this week. In the House, they finally decided to buckle down and figure out a financing plan for their version of the bill. The House announced on Friday that the way they want to pay for it is to impose an excise tax on the top 1% of earners in the United States. So basically what that's on their ordinary income. So right now the ordinary income, the top tax rate for ordinary income in the United States is about 35%. Now if the Democrats allow the Bush tax cuts to expire next year, and in the next year or two, that top tax rate might go up to about 39%. And if you add this excise tax on top of that, then the top earners in the U.S., those who make over $1 million a year, will pay about 45% about 45% income tax on their ordinary income. I just want to explain to people what ordinary income is. It's your wages, interest, and dividends, and that's it. Now, a lot of folks with incomes over $1 million a year don't have a lot of ordinary income because they have a lot of investments instead, and they make their money on capital gains. Capital gains tax rates are still obscenely low. So I find it kind of interesting that while the House Democrats think that adding an excise tax on top of the top ordinary income tax rates for people who don't generally have a lot of ordinary income to begin with is fine and will bring in about 500, I guess the number I saw was $564 billion over the next 10 years to pay for the plan. The Republicans are up in arms. They're screaming, oh, no, you can't tax the most productive members of society, when, in fact, I just want to point out that many of the folks who make more than $1 million a year don't work for a living. I just want to point that out.
I was going to say, most productive members of society aren't in the upper
1%. Aren't in the upper 1% of income earners, yes. And because, you know, when you have $1 million in capital gains and interest and dividends, why would you work? You know, truly, what I find interesting is that they didn't sit down and say, look, why don't we just solve all of our budgetary problems for the next 50 years and increase the capital gains tax rates back to where they ought to be, you know, or at least say, okay, look, if you make over X amount, if your income is over X amount, over $1 million a year, then we up your capital gains tax rate to the same as what your ordinary income tax rate would be, and allow people, you know, mom and pops who sell their home and get a capital gain from that, allow them to still pay the low capital gains tax rates. You know, they didn't talk about any of that. They talked about the one increase in tax for higher earners that is going to have the smallest impact on them.
All right. So there's ordinary income, and then there's this extraordinary income.
Yeah. Extraordinary income is capital gains. So you can own stocks and bonds. You can make your ordinary income from working a wage job, taking home your take home pay. Okay. That's ordinary income. And a lot of people pay a lot of tax on their ordinary income, even though they don't make much money. But also included in ordinary income, if you own stocks and bonds, are the interest earned on bonds and the dividends earned on stocks is also included in ordinary income. But there's a class of income called capital gains. When you decide to sell stock or sell your bonds, any gain that you make from the sale of that is considered a capital gain. Also, when you sell property, like if you sell a piece of land or if you sell your home and you have a gain on that sale, that's also considered capital gains. Well, a lot of wealthy people, sure, they make money on interest and dividends, but a lot of them make the bulk of their money on the sale of stocks and bonds. They'll sell the stocks and bonds, make a big chunk of gain, and then they'll turn that gain around and they'll buy more stocks and bonds, and they'll live off of some of it. That'll be some of their income for the year. But that is the bulk of their income. That's taxed at a much, much, much lower rate than ordinary income from wages, interest, and dividends.
And it should be the exact opposite.
It should be the opposite. Yeah, it really should.
All right. Anything else on healthcare bill-related issues?
No.
Okay. Let's move on. This week we heard murmurs that the Bush surveillance program might have been a bit bigger than
they
previously
have
noted.
Let us know. Yeah. It turns out that the warrantless wiretapping program that the Bush administration was engaged in is only one very tiny piece of an overall bigger, much, much bigger surveillance program, excuse me, that was undertaken by the Bush administration, signed off on by George W. Bush on a regular basis. He had to review the program every 45 days and give his authorization. And he did that. And Dick Cheney, his vice president, who was tasked with seeing that the program actually was implemented, and the CIA, successive CIA directors also signed off on the program on a regular basis. Excuse me. And it's interesting because this report that was released this week by five inspector generals, they were supposed to review the scope of FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which is this 30-year-old act that has created the secret court that would review the government electronic surveillance and has allowed government electronic surveillance to go on. These five inspector generals said, well, you know, look, this program was way bigger than just the warrantless wiretapping of foreign communications with U.S. citizens and foreign nationals resident in the United States. It encompassed a much, much bigger thing that, of course, we can't talk about in this report because then that would be declassifying it and releasing it to the public. So as it turns out, there are portions of this program, huge portions of this program, we know nothing about. What I find really interesting is that CIA Director Leon Panetta says, oh, you know, I've closed the program down. Well, well, how can we know that if we don't know the scope of the program in the first place? And secondly, he said he and other analysts have said at the CIA have said, well, you know, we didn't even know this program was operating. We never saw any data from it. Honestly, I don't believe that because how you know, for one thing, the idea that you need to collect all this data, if you're not showing it to anybody, any of the analysts at the CIA, it's a useless program. You're collecting the data for no reason. Secondly, I really don't believe that nobody saw it because when you get all this information, it doesn't just sit somewhere, you know, in a black box, in a locked black box where no one can see
it. It's sitting on computers.
Yeah, it's sitting on computers and people are looking at it. And people are looking at it and nobody other than the president and the CIA and the director of the CIA had any idea that this was going on. Nobody else in the federal government, including Congress, was able to review what was going on in this program and sign off on it. So I think this is a huge story. The fact that it's played on like the back page of the A section of the newspaper, the fact that you have hardly heard anything about it on TV or radio is astonishing to me.
Yeah, I would suspect it goes further than just getting data via, you know, electronic means like phones and or computers.
Mm-hmm.
I would suspect that there's active, you know, surveillance of people.
Well, and involved. We know too that through the warrantless wiretapping program that companies like AT&T allowed the CIA to come in and set up a shadow server to download all data that went through their lines.
Verizon,
everything,
another participant.
To literally duplicate the entire internet, for example.
Yeah.
So we know that that was part of the program, and we only know that because whistleblowers at AT&T came out and said that. Yes, I let in these tech guys to duplicate the internet. They came right in, they set up switches, they looked at everything.
I know Verizon is another one. Every time I see their commercial with all those guys standing in the background, I'm just thinking, oh, all those guys listening in.
Yep.
All right. Let's move on.
Those are all those government guys listening to your call.
Let's move on. We're running short on time. This week's economic news.
That's your network.
Yeah.
speaking of the economy, I want to talk a little bit about the developing trade and state government IOUs. In the past week, states that haven't been able to balance their budgets, but their June 30th fiscal deadline has come and gone, they've had to issue IOUs in order to pay for goods and services. The biggest state to do this is California, the state of California. As of Wednesday, the state of California had issued more than 90,000 IOUs worth more than $354 million to pay bills to businesses, individuals that work for the states, and to local governments that usually get some kind of revenue from the state. And California is expected just this month to issue a total of some $3.3 billion in IOUs. Now, the problem with that is that some of these folks that they're paying need to get cash right now. They need cash to pay their own bills. So there's this trade that has developed in IOUs. It started out with some folks on Craigslist offering cash for IOUs. And, of course, the amount of cash that they offered was less than the face value of the IOUs. The IOUs, it turns out, will be due for payment on or before October 2nd. So California will pony up the money, the face value of the IOUs on October 2nd. And the IOUs carry an interest rate of 3.75%. So if you can afford to hold that IOU for the next 3 months, you will eventually get paid your money plus 3.75%. But many of the businesses that are getting these IOUs instead of cash from the state of California say, look, we can't do that. We can't hold it for 3 months. We got to pay our own bills. So they're looking for places to sell these. And then three of the biggest banks in the country said that, well, we're going to stop taking California IOUs. We're going to stop honoring those. Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and Citigroup, no surprise. These are three of the biggest banks that are in the biggest, trouble in terms of their, in terms of loan defaults and being able to cover their own bills, have said, well, we can't give people cash for the IOUs anymore because that means we're stuck holding them and we can't afford that. We need cash right now to cover our capital requirements. So they're going to stop taking IOUs. But this is interesting, too, because a whole bunch of the credit unions in the state of California came out and said, well, we're doing the opposite. we're fine. We will honor those IOUs if you bring them to us, which I think really points out the difference between, well, really points out the reason why you need small banks versus why you need big, consolidated, huge national or international banks, because those big, consolidated, huge national or international banks can't respond to a situation like this like a small bank can. But interestingly, also this week, the SEC stepped in and said, well, this is a mess, this whole situation with the California IOUs. We can see that there's there's a possibility of fraud here, because any joker can print up a piece of paper with a California state seal on it and say this is an IOU and try to sell it over the internet. So the SEC stepped in and they declared the IOUs a security and said that they should be regulated by the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board, which regulates municipal bonds. And so basically the SEC said, look, these IOUs really are a form of municipal bond, and people should be looking at them in those terms. That also means now that people can't just buy and sell them over Craigslist anymore. The SEC announcement means that only registered brokers should be able to buy and sell California state IOUs. So the SEC is trying to step in and say, look, it's not the Wild West here. You know, California IOUs, they're going to be good for them, and we're just going to kind of try to put a lid on this whole situation. I thought that was kind of interesting, an interesting development that people would want to know about, and really to kind of see the way capitalism works without regulation, and then when the regulators step in and why they step in.
All right. Unfortunately, only a few minutes left to cover international, starting with China.
Yeah, I want to talk about the riots in western China that's left more than 150 people dead and thousands of people arrested by Chinese police. The riots have been going on in Urumqi in the Xinjiang province in western China. It's China's westernmost province. It shares a long border with the stans, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Pakistan, Kazakhstan, all these former Soviet republics. Urumqi sits in the Tian Shan Mountains, if you look at a map, and with deserts to the north and south of it. And there's a major railway line and a major highway that runs from the heart of China. It's really the only major rail line and highway that run from the heart of eastern China, the most populous part of that part of the world, west into Kazakhstan, which is the south of the former Soviet Union. It's really kind of a crossroads, and hundreds and thousands of years ago, Urumqi and Kashgar, another city in western China, were on the Silk Road, which was the main route from the Levant or the Middle East, which was the most highly populated in Western Europe, the most highly populated parts of the Western world then, into the Far East, into China and other parts of the Far East. You had to pretty much go through that part of the world, through Urumqi and Kashgar, to get there. So it's these are very, very old cities with a unique culture, with an indigenous population that has lived there for thousands of years, that has their own language. It has Urumqi and Kashgar in particular have these ancient ruins that are fabulous. They are fantastic, and they're at risk of being lost now that China is trying to develop the western part of its country. China has basically looked at the West and said, how can we replicate Western rates of growth without doing it the way that we have here in the West, with massive overconsumption, with building a house of cards with our financial industry, et cetera. And the way China's doing it is by taking excess population, people who don't make a lot of money, who are basically the poor in their eastern cities, and relocating them to the western parts of China, to their frontier, to help with resource extraction and building up their industry. So. And that means development in parts of China that where things haven't changed much for hundreds and thousands of years, and that's creating a lot of problems right now. So that's a big part of what's behind these riots.
All right. Unfortunately, running out of time here.
That's all right.
A couple quick words about the G8.
Yeah, the G8 summit finished in Europe this week, and they were supposed to come to some kind of a deal on carbon emissions, and really nothing much happened. They set a long-term commitment to cut carbon emissions by 80% by 2050, but the hope was that they would set a short-term goal of cuts by 2020, and they haven't gotten there yet at all. It's basically boiled down to this kind of schoolyard, well, we want you to go first. We want the developing nations to declare cuts first before the developed nations will do that. And that's just childish, irresponsible, and it's wrong.
Talking with Maria Tomchik with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
People can find Eat the State around town, where you find free publications in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, in the King County Library System. You can also find us online at www.eatthestate.org.